Introducing Rav Moshe Aberman at 9 o'clock sharp on a Thursday morning as we zip along with Zoom with the Friday Shkola. Rav Aberman will continue with the literature of the post Second Temple era. So we're up to Achronim already. We're up to the Achronim, I think, right? Are we still into the latter part of the Rishonim?
Still talk about the Rishonim. We're still with the commentaries on the Torah. So last time we elaborated on some of the Parshanut and Torah from Spain, France, Provence. We'll move on a little from there onto some of the other commentaries. As you'll see, the primary classic Parshanut does come from Spain and to some extent from France, but there are some Parshanim, well-known Parshanim, from other places as well. Bruce asked about Italy. He seems to have this fixation with Italy. So,
no, just I'm curious about things I know very little about. So we know a little about Italian writing, and also just what Jews were writing in general, maybe philosophical works or what else they were writing. I mean,
so there were several well-known commentaries written in Italy. The first that we'll just relate to shortly is Rabbi Ishaya Mitrani, who lived in the first half of the Rishonic period. The approximation, again, a lot of Rishonim, we don't have clear dates, even years, of their birth and death, but the approximation from different sources is that he was born approximately 1190 and passed away in the year of 1255.
Would you say that people those days knew who their contemporaries were and people prior to them? Or were they very isolated in the sense they really were not aware of other writings that might have been current in their same time period?
Well, they were aware. There are varieties of how much they may have been exposed to the writings and the thoughts of others. And that varies to some extent on a personal level, it varies on a geographic location, how much information was conveyed or not. But we clearly see that in most of these Sfarim in the Rishonic period, they quote other scholars from even other geographic locations, so that there was a give and take. Let's remember, I gave that as an example of, because it's so classic, but there were others as well. There was also a migration of individuals between these different Torah centers. The classic example that I gave was the Rosh. The Rosh, who was born in Germany, then fled from Germany, spent years in France, was very much affected by the French Tosfot approach, and later moved to Spain, where he interacts with the Rashba and other contemporaries in Spain, but becomes one of the leading, if not the leading, Torah authority in Spain. So here we have this Ashkenazic personality who goes through France to Germany and definitely carries with him to these different places a certain tradition, a certain knowledge from the places that he has been, and the cross effect is such. But he's not the only one, and therefore there was a lot of information that was conveyed, again, within the limitations, because we didn't have, you know, the tip end of the Rishonic period, you find already some kind of printing. But most of the Rishonic period is still limited to hand manuscripts, and therefore the amount of books that are produced and therefore their availability to people is more limited. It is true that on some level it affected the way people learned. In other words, today when people learn, most people are not reading a text with the intent of more or less remembering every aspect that's in it and literally memorizing. Because we know the books are available to us, and as long as we know where to find them, what to look for, we can always take the book. And therefore, the focuses today in study are different than they were during the earlier periods. But when those books are not available to you, and you know you have a manuscript that's going to be there, you're going to see it, you know, a few times for a period of time, then the study is such that the learning attempts to literally memorize as much as possible the content of the book. And therefore, you find that these people are able to literally quote. They'll say, you know, the book is not before me, but they quote, yeah, there'll be some, you know, something was off a little bit, but the overall knowledge is such. So that there was a cross-information, cross-knowledge between different scholars in the Torah world in Europe. There's also a certain amount of knowledge that is conveyed and crosses from Northern Africa, even let's say Yemen, and so on, that we find different knowledge that people have of what is written or said in other places. So that it existed. Obviously, it's nowhere like we have today that somebody can say something and 2 hours later, throughout the world, people know about it. Okay, that's the reality of modern technology. But even then, the information was available, but many times it wasn't. And that explains the differences that we find in writing. Someone who's been exposed to things will relate to it. Others who were not exposed to other thinkers or other writers, therefore coming and creating their own thing. And therefore, we'll sometimes see that, wait a second, he doesn't mention it, but he's basically saying something like someone who preceded him wrote. That's not because he was plagiarizing, but simply did not have the data in front of him. So there's a lot of variance in the amount of knowledge that Rishonim had of fellow scholars, but the fact that there are Torah centers, that I think that everybody knew that there were other Torah centers throughout the world. Okay, let's get back to the specifics here. So the first one I mentioned here is Rabbi Sheya Mitrani, otherwise known as the Reed. He is, though he's in Italy, his style of learning, his association in Talmudic learning is a Tosfotist approach, and he's affected by the Balei HaTosfot in France. He may have even been there and learned there for a while, and he writes also a book of Tosfot Reed on Sur Masechtot Mishas. He also wrote a Perush al Torah that's known as Nimukei HaChumash, in which he has that impact or the effect of the Tosfot approach to reading the Torah. The next personality that is interesting from Italy is Rabbi Menachem Recanati, otherwise known in short as the Recanati. Now, Menachem Recanati is most known for his book on tefillah. Okay? A lot of knowledge, both of customs and understanding of things in tefillah, come from what Rabbi Menachem Recanati wrote. But alongside this really monumental book, a work that he did on that, he obviously was a halachic authority in Italy, but was also a Kabbalist. Again, I note Kabbalist in the terms of the Kabbalah of the Rishonic period, And his Perush al HaTorah is very heavily Kabbalistic. In other words, if you take it and you try to read it, a lot of it will seem just vague and hard to understand because its foundation is very Kabbalistic. As opposed to, let's say, the Ramban that we mentioned, it brings in Kabbalistic views, but does it as a sort of addition or alongside more rationalistic thinking, the Recanati is fundamentally or heavily Kabbalistic in his pitch. The last of the Italian Torah or Parshanat Torah that I wanted to relate to is probably the one that is also best known, is Rabbi Ovadia Sforno. Okay, the Sforno. Sforno is printed in many of the Mikraot Gedolot. It definitely appears in the Mosad Rav Kook, Torat Chaim. And it's one of the books that they put in work and put out in a more scientific edition. Rabbi Ovadia Sforno is the edge, literally the end of the Rishonic period. You could even say that on some level he's already leaning into the Achronic period. And therefore, if somebody came and said to me, no, he's not a Rishon, he's an Achron, I wouldn't argue that point. I think he still falls into the category of the Rishonim, but he really is on the border of the Rishonic Achronic period. His approach in his commentary to the Torah is a shot approach. And in that sense, the Sforno is also easy to read. The Sforno is very simple in his approach and literally tries to stay with the Pshat HaPsukim. But he does expand and then relate to also giving a stress to where it's relevant, obviously, to messages of Musar and proper behavior. In other words, he incorporates into a book that's fundamentally coming to give a commentary to help us understand the Sukkim and the Torah. He includes into it also messages that are meant to give us sort of guidelines how to use and what to take and extract from the Torah to our practical life. Yes, please.
So can you separate between Parshanut and Darshanut? Some of these commentaries are, what's the Torah saying? And others are, what can we do with that information? And if they want to teach something else.
It's true. But you see, when you have classic, where you fully focus as Parshanut, then you're really not looking, obviously, you're not looking to convey any kind of values or messages to people. Obviously, what's written in the Torah may have its values, and then the reader can therefore extract from it, but he's not. In Darshanut, you're right that the primary purpose is to convey a certain thought, a certain idea of how one should interact and behave. But the Darshanut, in most cases in Darshanut, the Pasuk is more of what would be learned or used in learning circles, a hechatimtze, an excuse, a reasoning or a basis to come and say what I'm saying. But there's no attempt to really understand the context of the psukim. That doesn't mean that every darshan doesn't relate to it, but darshanut really is not interested in understanding the psukim in their true sense and the story as such, but to look, to use it as a sort of stepping stone, as a starting point to convey some kind of message and idea. The Sforno in that doesn't quite, at least the places that I encountered, doesn't quite go to a Darshanut aspect. But he does try to stress the aspects that stem from the Parshanut into how we should live and our values. So it sits somewhere in between those two elements, Parshanut and Darshanut. The Sfarnu was a scholar. As my knowledge, he was also a doctor. And it's interesting to note how he relates to it. It's in his commentary, the Sfarnu outright does not aspire to write for scholars, to big chidushim for scholars. He is writing a work that is meant for the average public, the lay person, and as such, to educate them. The Sfarnu himself was well educated. Yet, he did not necessarily promote this as an ideal. Right? Let's say, in images that we're familiar with, right? Rav Soloveitchik believed that broad scholarship was something that contributed to the enrichment and the value of your Torah study. And therefore, he not only incorporated his own knowledge into things that he taught, wrote, and so on, but he encouraged and pushed his Talmidim to expose themselves to further general studies. There are others who were knowledgeable, had studied the general studies, but did not necessarily promote that in any way. It's a little different, but the Lubavitcher Rebbe, right, also was exposed to general studies, and yet you don't find in his writings any kind of encouragement to go to university, study in universities, and things of that sort. The Sfarnu, in that sense, was very much like that. He was known to be a broad scholar, but yet he did not encourage that as a value in itself. That is, to him, the Torah was the essence of learning. For different reasons, some people might find it worthy of exposing themselves like he did, and he didn't oppose that, but he didn't feel that that was something that had to be the norm of every Jew's study. Now,
was that more the norm in what became Spain?
It was. I don't know that every Jew, and that's what I was about to say. We have to put it also into the context of the period. As we're talking about the Middle Ages, right? The Sfarnu already is more into the Enlightenment period, but a little bit. But you're talking about the Middle Ages, where the average person was not exposed to any significant education, if any education at all. So that there was automatically a natural selection of who was involved in broadening their educational horizons and who not. So that the idea of saying not everybody has to expose themselves to general studies was something that was reasonable. You can live a good life and, you know, be a very effective member of society without being a scholar, without being exposed to this knowledge. That is somewhat different today, when so much of the possibility of doing things is dependent on exposing yourself to broader scholarship. I don't know where the Sforno, if Sforno were to live today, where the Sforno would be in that sense. Would he still also limit his encouragement to general studies, or would he feel that today it's more critical? I don't know. I know that he himself does not feel that this is an essential aspect of a person's growth. And, for example, in his Perush to Pirkei Avot, okay, on the Mishnah, Afochba v'Afochba v'Kuleba, he writes, Afochba Torah la'avin u'la'abit nifla'ot mimena ve'lo titztarech le'sifrei filosofei ha'umot v'chokrehem. In other words, he's saying, if you want to expand, you want to have an understanding, you want to be a sort of intellectual person, you can study Torah, and if you delve into it well enough, you won't need the books of the philosophers and the researchers of the Goyim. That sounds almost like a line that would come out of a Haredi rav in our days, right? Who needs education? Says Hafachba the Kulaba. Right? Why is it Gemara Shahakul? Gemara Bavli Shahakul Bavluba? You can find everything. Okay. Was that the thinking of the Sforno? I don't think so. Because I think the Sforno respects the value of broader exposure, but A, the kind of knowledge that existed then wasn't giving all that much more than learning Torah. Because what it was giving was skills of thought, skills of analysis, which one can truly get from learning Torah. It gave a certain knowledge without any question, especially a person like wanting to be a doctor, a certain biological knowledge that they had, whatever levels they had. But it wasn't the kind of collection or data that exists today that can completely open your mind in completely different ways. So as I said, the Sforno is saying it, but I'm not sure that the Sforno would necessarily say the same thing today. Yes, Mr.
I'm just wondering about, I guess it's the Rambam approach, to understand the world that God created. And it's convenient, I suppose, if we're not living in our own country, to just be scholarly about the Torah. But once, originally, we came from a land, and now we're back in the land, and to run any kind of a country, you have to know how to do that. So you can't just be sitting learning Torah in that sense. Military knowledge, medical knowledge, architectural knowledge, construction, everything to run a society. So I'm not sure when we lost that idea that it's valuable and part of the bigger world of Torah to know God's world and restrict it just to, like, you know, the books. Froze. It was a shocking question. Now he's
there's a lot of thought.
I guess. He's gonna have to come back on. This is where it requires editing. We have to go back in and, like, or we just let it run. Yep, there we go. I guess it's people's internet connection.
Yeah, or power, or both.
So I'm going to, about 6:40, get the pizza, and I'll swing by. Slice around.
Thank
that
you.
Time.
Mm-hmm.
It's not coming back on quickly. My brother went off today with his wife to buy bus to go to the Israel Museum, Dead Sea Scrolls, and maybe see where their son works in Rehovia. Sort of a high-tech kind of an office. Oh, so America may require the rapid antigen test. And we're trying to figure out where he could do it, because it has to be within 24 hours of the flight. His flight is Monday, 11:30. So you need the PCA to get into the terminal. That's an Israeli requirement. And then now you may need, Biden may require the antigen, rapid antigen test to land, to fly into America.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they have it at MDA stations and urgent.
Yeah, stations. MDA. I mean, like, that's where, like, when I've gone on my trips, that's where I end up going because I need to get a test, but I got to get the test.
Where is the nearest one that you get it at?
Yerushalayim. Uh-huh. The main facility in Yerushalayim.
And where is that? Up and near the bus station?
Yeah, yeah. Welcome back.
Okay, we lost you there.
Yes, I, for some reason, lost my internet, so I just had to create a hotspot.
It didn't like my question.
Okay. I was saying that in reference to what you said about the Rambam.
Or just in life. It was not just the Rambam, but...
First of all, even in reference to the Rambam, who was relatively extreme in that sense, I think that there would be those who would argue with you and say that that wasn't the Rambam's approach. Rambam was exposed and did connect to general studies, but he didn't think that everything was dependent on that. You will find that on many of these issues, there are different perspectives. When you hear it from people who are more academically oriented and people who are more yeshiva oriented. And I'm not coming at the moment to make an assessment who is more correct and who's less correct in my own view, definitely objective. So even when you take the Rambam, I think you have to be aware that those who take a different stance will soften the position that you presented as a reference to the Rambam. And I think the Sforno could be a very good proof of that aspect. The Sforno, who himself is a big scholar, more than that, the Sforno was it's an interesting aspect of reference to Sforno. The Sforno, I'll add it in here and include it into this answer. The Sforno was very much of a scholar of Hebrew, to the extent that he wrote books on the language of Hebrew and taught Hebrew. One of the people who studied Hebrew with the Sforno was a person known as Martin Luther, one of the founding establishers of the Protestant movement in Germany. He was for a period of time in Italy, and he learned because he was interested in studying, because there was this interest in the sources, and therefore he was interested in Hebrew. He learned Hebrew with the Sforno, which A, reflects the stature of how the Sforno was perceived as a scholar, that a person like this would come and learn with him. B, it shows a certain openness of the Sforno to the fact that he's teaching, not necessarily teaching Torah content, he's teaching Hebrew and giving skills to a non-Jew who will then use it in learning Torah. And on the other hand, we see a statement that he can make here, Hafuch ba Torah, lahabinu lahabit mitlot mimena, you know, delve in the Torah, velo titztarech lesifrei filosofei ha'umot v'shkoyim. And then you won't need all the books and all this knowledge of the philosophers and their researchers. So that even in the more scholarly more knowledgeable and exposed personalities, there are views and differences and more complexity than that.
We see so many stories about them working and learning.
It doesn't prove anything. I'm trying to sort of present a complexity in the picture here. I want to make clear, I'm not trying to defend or identify with the position of both more closed in and less open to scholarship. My own positions are somewhat known, but I do think we have to look at things in a more complex and a broader picture of things. At the time of the Rishonim, there wasn't a phenomenon of a kol, and it couldn't be, because most people didn't have that financial capacity to support others in learning. Even Talmidei Chachamim, even Rabbani, in many cases, needed to work to support themselves. It wasn't a question of necessarily ideological choice. It was a pragmatic reality that you couldn't support yourself just by being a Rosh Hashanah, or just being a rabbi of a community. So that it's hard to assess, because they work, does that mean that they, if they lived in today's reality, would they choose to do it in that
way? But that suggests that the ideal is to sit and learn. And b'diavad, if you don't win the lottery, you should be working, as opposed to this value, great value, in working.
I don't know how many you might be able to find in the Rishonim statements that turn it into an ideal or a value. But I don't know how many of them really saw this completely as an ideal or value, and if they were wealthy, would necessarily have run to work or been able to. I think that, taking out, and that's a problem, because both sides do it. Extract a line here, a line there, and try to turn that into a whole ideology, I think is something we always have to be careful. Most of these people were great scholars in the sense of scholarship as a whole, and therefore their thinking was complex. And when you try to turn it into black and white, one-dimensional, you're usually distorting what they're doing. The Havdil, right, when Rav Soloveitchik passed away, there was a lot of arguing about the image of Rav Soloveitchik. And on the one side, those who tried to turn him into a Jewish philosopher. On the other hand, you had those who turned him into the normative Lithuanian Rosh Hashanah, and had nothing to do with the world of general scholarship. Because each person was looking at it and trying to force his personality into their perspective. I think that the same thing is often done with the Rishonim on both ends, and we have to be careful with that. I just want to add in one thing before I move on. In reference to the specific point that you made, Bruce, as far as running a society, a government, and so on. Number one, I don't know, there are things that have to be learned. And even the most Haredi of societies will not reject the study of things that are pragmatic and serve a purpose. But that's those people who need and are doing it. Secondly, I don't know that the Haredi leadership has shown any less capability of leadership, of running things, of doing things from their point of view, from their interest, than certain other leaders. And lastly, a certain complexity, but a complexity that exists today doesn't have to exist in the ideal world. In other words, part of complexity exists today on the legal basis, for example, is an issue of how do you build a legal system that is able to interact with today's reality. Why is it a problem in today's reality? Because we have a secular law. If you took out the secular law, try to think about it, you took out the secular law completely, and you had a religious law. The religious law, as we have it, doesn't answer 100% of the issues. But in the same way as poskim are able to take halachic sugya and deal with other issues and come up with answers, they could do it here too. And some of it has been done by certain writers and certain gedolim. Herzog stands out in that sense, and so on. So that it's not, it's more of a demagogical answer or statement towards those who think otherwise, that you couldn't do it. I'm not so sure it couldn't be done. If the reality was different. In the given reality, so that brings us into other questions and other arguments. But when we talk about the issue of the Rishonim, I think we have to stress there was a segment of the Rishonim, particularly in Spain and Italy, who were well-versed in general studies and scholarship. On the other hand, the Germanic Rishonim, and to a great extent also, I think, the French Rishonim, were less involved in that, were less interested in that. And it's hard to say that one was necessarily more capable, better than the other in an absolute term. It's hard, therefore, to say all the Rishonim thought in a certain way. It's not correct. It's not true. The complexity of existing Rishonim exists today, and everything has to be, I think, studied and related to in complex forms and understanding the pros and cons either way and not in absolute lines. And I'll suffice with that. Anyway, going back to the Sforno, as I said, Sforno also interacted with non-Jews, and one of the things that he stressed very much is similar, very similar to things that appear in the Rambam. In other words, observe God's interaction with the world, His mercy, that He built or created in His image, so that the one who is studying and observing, that will lead him to be like God as much as possible. The idea of appreciating God, understanding God, and therefore also going in His footsteps in that sense, is something that the Sforno stresses and makes that a mainstay in his Parshanut al HaTorah. Okay, that's as far as the Italian Parshanei Torah. Interestingly, there is, though we don't have, at least in a broad exposure, we don't have that much before us, but it's important to note that there were several Taimani commentaries on the Torah. What is interesting also when noting that, at least the ones that I was able to see that have brought down in the encyclopedias and so on, are in the latter part of the Rishonic period. In other words, you're talking about mid 1300s, 1329, the earliest ones, and others are 1400 into the 1500s. I think that that's an important point to note because it seems, and I can't say for sure, it seems that the Taimani communities in the early Rishonic period were lacking somewhat in Torah leadership and guidance. And that's why we find that the Taimanim turned to the Rambam to help them contend with challenges and problems and questions that they have. And obviously, the scholarship developed and evolved later on, and that's what we find a reflection of it in the Pirushim of the Torah in the latter part of the Rishonic period. From here, we move on to the Ashkenazic. Okay, in Ashkenaz in Germany, again, you don't have a large or rich number of Pirushim al Torah. a function, I think, of the rigidness of the Ashkenazic, the Germanic Torah study, which was very halachically oriented and focused. But one image that stands out very much is Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid. He lives at the end of the 12th century into the 13th century. The Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid is an image who, on the one hand, is part of a tradition or a line of Torah scholarship that existed in his family, the Clodimus family that migrated from Italy to Germany, but because of their scholarship, become leaders in Germany. To the extent that Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid's father, Rabbi Shmuel Clonimus, begins a movement, or he is at least seen as the beginning of the movement, that is known as Chassidei Ashkenaz. Okay? The reason they call Chassidei Ashkenaz is because it's meant to differentiate between the modern post Baal Shem Tov Chassidut. Okay? But when you look in any of their writings, they just talk about Chassidim. And the reality is that the Chassidei Ashkenaz in that were probably closer to the term Chassid or Chassidut found in the Gemara than the modern day Chassidut. The Chassidei Ashkenaz was a movement that there are differing opinions on how broad it was in Ashkenaz. There are those who limited extremely to a very small elite group. Others see it as having a much broader, if not full commitment, but a much broader influence on overall life in Germany during that period. But it's definitely an important phenomenon that should be noted that is part of the Rishonic period. The Chassidei Ashkenaz develop an ideology, and that ideology has a combination of different sources in different components. They include some of the Rishonic Kabbalah, but often, and I'm not an expert on it, but from things I've read up, take it in a somewhat different direction than the classic Kabbalists in the Rishonic period, but the Kabbalah is part of their world. They develop, or probably the earliest systematic development of a Musar movement. Musar in the sense of a movement that is coming to work and develop your midot, your personal integrity. Yes, Mr.
I think we once had a shir in my home regarding a book related to Chassid Ashkenaz. There's a book that has their...
There's a book, right, I was going to get to that.
It has all these unusual chumras that they're not...
Okay, so there is a book written by Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid, which is the central book associated to the Chassidei Ashkenaz movement. And there are other writings, but the most comprehensive book is that written by the same Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid, Sefer Chassidim.
Right.
Sefer Chassidim. Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid writes it, and yes, the data there, or the ideas there, are perceived as extreme, eccentric almost, because that was part of the Chassidic movement. It was an ultra-conservative thinking in the sense of the commitment to the fulfillment of mitzvot. And from that perspective, bringing in Kabbalah and other things, built an approach of life, practical and pragmatic way of life, that would be seen as a very almost harsh and very conservative, limiting way of life. One of the areas that the Ashkenazic Hasidic movement focused on very much was the idea of tshuva. And they developed all kinds of values of tshuva. They even though they're not the only ones who come, but they put it into a structured thinking the idea that when one sins, he's basically affecting two different realms. One is he's affecting negatively HaKadosh Baruch. That's the Kabbalistic effect of their thinking. And the other is he affects himself, as he undermines his personality, his whole being. He makes himself a worse person. And the process of tshuva, accordingly, has to relate to those aspects. And so one element of it is how to return, come back to Kadosh Baruch Hu. But the other is what's called tshuvat mishkal. In other words, the mita keneged mita, taking upon yourself certain hardships and suffering to purify your soul for the bad deeds that you've done. And that's part of the Hasidut Ashkenaz, this movement's thinking. Besides his book, Sefer Hasidim, Rabbi Yehuda Hasid also wrote a tzava, a well-known tzava, known as Tzavat Rabbi Yehuda Hasid, in which he guides family, his students, his followers, in reference to how to live and certain customs to take upon it. Not, and this has brought about a rather broad discussion to what extent to see this tzava as a halachic work or not, to what extent to relate to some of the things that are in tzava Rabbi Yehuda Hasid. And there are those who really limit themselves in all kinds of things, and sometimes even to this day, take upon themselves all kinds of minhugim that are somewhat eccentric or seen as a somewhat extreme based on this writings of these writings of Rabbi Yehuda Hasid. Rabbi Yehuda Hasid wrote a perush al Torah. This perush was known of, and I assume there was also quotes of it, but it didn't appear in an exposed manner for generations. And I think it was 1984, but I'm not sure. No, it was in the 70s. Somebody put together, did a work, and put together the Perush, or supposedly from the Kitvei Yad, what the Perush is. And in that Perush, there were a lot of things that were questionable in the sense that they would fall into biblical criticism. In other words, statements of this wasn't written, or what's written here was originally and changed, and this was added in different times, and so on. Because
what book is that in?
His Perush HaTorah. Rabbi Yehuda Hasid's Perush HaTorah. Because of the stature of Rabbi Yehuda Hasid, being a leader of his time of Ashkenazic Germanic Jewry, and his impact also on halacha otherwise, this was something that raised a significant ruckus amongst the Talmidei Chachamim. Because if Rabbi Yehuda Hasid can say such things, then you're saying, you're legitimizing the idea that not all of Torah is what was given to Moshe from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. This brought about that the Rav in, I think it's in Zurich, wrote to Rav Moshe Feinstein about it. And Rav Moshe Feinstein writes first a tshuva to him, in which he clearly says, you have to get rid of this book. It's kfira. Basically, not stating that Rabbi Yehuda Hasid is a pope. But Rav Moshe's claim was that this could not have come from Rabbi Yehuda Hasid, that these are Talmidim. And by the way, most of Rabbi Yehuda Hasid's writings are not his own writings. In other words, it's things that come from his son and other Talmidim. So that there is a certain legitimacy in that, that some kofar used Rabbi Yehuda Hasid as a base to put in things of kfira. And in it, he relates to some of the things. This is a tshuva of Rav Moshe Feinstein's. We don't really have time to go through it. But there's a tshuva in Yoredeya Chelek Gimel Siman Kuf Yudalid, in which he mentions some of the faults. For example, and the pasuk Vayasim et Ephraim Lifnei Mashiach B'Masheh. So there's a whole discussion there in the sense that maybe this is Moshe. It's referring to Moshe, who puts Ephraim before Menashe by putting Ephraim as the head of the Degel, right? And then he rejects it and says, no, this is something that was written by Yehoshua. In other words, he's coming and saying, not only the question that appears in the Gemara as far as the last eight psukim of Torah, but here Yehoshua puts in things into Sefer Bereishit. Moshe Feinstein rejects this, says it's ridiculous. He says, furthermore, the whole idea of relating it to the Gullim and saying it's Moshe to begin with was nonsense, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the one who determines who the Gullim are, and he shows it in the Pesukim. Then he refers to another fault that existed there, and that is, this is almost shocking, okay, that when it says the Shira on the Be'er, Eli Be'er, Chafru Asarim, and so on, he says, in this book, it says that originally the Shira that they said was actually Halal Adodol, the Halal that we said today, not how we said today, how we say in and in Leila Seder, it was Halal Adodol, but David HaMelech took it out and in sort of infused it or paused it into Tehillim, and put in these other psukim in place. You know, extreme. Some of these things are extreme biblical critic kind of thingy. And therefore, Moshe basically rejects it and tells him to try to stop the printing. When that doesn't succeed, what happens is it goes out to print and it creates further ruckus. And then it gets here in Israel, and Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach and Rav Yoshiv come to an agreement with the publishers or something that they will omit like three pages or something that have these serious issues, and they will write in the introduction that there were these things that clearly were kfira, were some kind of fake, and therefore they were omitted from the book. Rav Moshe Feinstein hears about this and writes to Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, stating to him that he feels that's not enough, that they have to completely take this whole book out. And he says to him, because beyond those things, when this Rav sent him a copy of the book so he can see what it's all about, and he looks at it, he says, beyond this, I see things. I see that he questions the whole Isur and tries to create some kind of distorted aspect or explanation on the Isur of Mishkan Sachar. Says that's not acceptable. How can you leave it in there? And therefore, he literally, and if you know Rav Moshe Feinstein's gentleness in his writing and his sort of carefulness, you realize how worked up he is about it. And he says to Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, not somebody, he says to him that book has to be taken and it has to literally be burned. Right? You have to get rid of it completely. So you see one side of it, and there's good reason to think that there was some forgery in it. It doesn't fit the conservativeness of Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid. This would create a major dissonance in his whole overall personality. But interestingly, and I'll conclude that, interestingly, the person who's usually attacks Reb Moshe Feinstein, goes against Reb Moshe Feinstein from the perspective of Reb Moshe being too lenient and is much more conservative, Reb Menashe Klein, Menashe HaKatan, he writes that his problems can be resolved and be explained, and that actually, the tshuva of the Reb Moshe, right? The tshuva of the Reb Moshe are students of his who wrote this, and Reb Moshe would never have written such a thing. He doesn't believe Reb Moshe Feinstein wrote these tshuva, and this is all one big fake. So you see how things like this created a major ruckus. I'll just conclude with a half a sentence. Amongst the different places where we find commentaries on the Torah, we find also a well-known, and some of it was lost, some of it exists, a perush on the Torah of Rabbi Avraham ben Harambam. Rabbi Avraham ben Harambam basically lived in Egypt, grew up, lived in Egypt when the Rambam got there. He was born to the Rambam at a relatively late age. The Rambam was 51, was a phenomenal scholar of his own, focused a lot on explaining and presenting and exposing the Rambam to the public and answering questions that were raised on the Rambam. But he himself was also a doctor, a king's doctor like the Rambam, headed a hospital, and wrote a lot of Torah, including his Perush al HaTorah. And this is unique in the sense that Egypt was not known as a Torah center, but the presence of a scholar in the capacity of Rabbi Avraham ben Harambam brings about a situation that even from Egypt we find Parshanut al Torah that was, some of it was lost and some of it was printed. There's on Bereishit and Shmot, anybody who would like to look it up in Hebrew books. Adkan. I'm holding back the next shiur. So have a Chanukah Sameach. We will move
Thank
on
you.
With other aspects of the Rishonic literature. Yirtzeh Hashem next week.
Thank you, Rabbi Abraham. Thank you. Shabbat Shalom.